Constance, I can tell you, the baby's not alive. Is it your baby?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So just to clarify, you just told me the baby that we found this evening.
Yeah.
Is your baby.
Yeah.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Footage of a burning car literally set the nation alight with the interest in this particular case. The case of Constance Martin and Mark Gordon is one that has genuinely set the nation on fire, talking about the guilt, culpability, and also the feelings of empathy to a certain degree with one of the individuals in this case. Whether you are going to find sympathy and empathy with Constance Martin, well, that remains to be seen, but nonetheless, it is one of those cases that I've been curious about since the get-go. And even though they haven't been sentenced officially, we do have the verdicts on this case, and I wanted to cover it because I know that a lot of you have been hugely curious about this, and you have actually emailed me and sent messages to me asking me to cover it, so I'm going to do so today. Let's talk about Constance Martin, because she's somebody, to all intents and purposes, where you end up shaking your head because you cannot quite compute how it all went wrong. She came from an unbelievable life of privilege. It's a kind of background where stability and education and opportunity are genuinely within easy reach. But it feels as if this sliding doors moment occurs when she meets Mark Gordon. And Mark Gordon is an individual with a deeply troubling past. And I mean deeply troubling. He's had a conviction for really violent rape, for example, which is the worst of the worst. Now, after she meets him, Martin basically withdraws from her family. She distances herself from her previous life, and she follows Gordon into a relationship that, as far as I'm concerned, is dysfunctional, I would imagine aggressive and violent, and is definitely marked by secrecy and instability, which are not the hallmarks of a positive relationship. They live this really chaotic, transient life, and their first four children were taken into care. And when Constance became pregnant with her fifth child, they basically go to extreme lengths to hide it. They wanted to keep their baby. They didn't want social services getting involved. They didn't want that child removed from their care. So after baby Victoria is born in secrecy, without any medical support whatsoever, they go off grid. They even end up sleeping in a tent. And I mean, it's bitter winter at the time that they're doing this. And this is really where that national search grips the country. Any of us who were following the case just wanted to know that the baby was safe. Now, when they are finally found, sadly, the little baby girl isn't with them. And the case unfolds in a really tragic way. But I think unusually, I have a level of sympathy and empathy with Constance Martin. I feel there is a level of trauma, manipulation. I also feel that she struggled, and indeed he struggled, her partner, with some mental health issues. But the reality is we have to concentrate on what matters. We have to concentrate on that tiny baby girl who never really got the chance to live. Let's talk about Constance in more detail. So she was born on the 16th of May 1987. She was born to mother Virginia Camus and father Napier Martin. Her parents had married in 1986. I think from just listening to the names themselves, you can imagine that we're dealing with aristocracy when it comes down to the society these individuals came from. Now, Constance was the eldest of four children. She had three younger brothers, Maximilian, Tobias, and Frederick. Amazing names, but also indicative of the class that they came from in the UK. And they were indeed an aristocratic family. Virginia's family had really close links to the royal family. Napier studied at Eton, creme de la creme of public school in the UK, and had also been a page to Queen Elizabeth, and Virginia was a socialite. So a socialite is someone who does that, socializes, moves around as a particular individual of means, doing lots of social things, working here and there for charities, and having a right old time, to be honest, because money is not an issue. Now, later, she worked as a psychotherapist, and she specialized in trauma, family therapy, and grief. Napier and Virginia raised their children in a manor, a place called Crystal House in Dorset, which is basically a stately home. So genuinely, every trapping that one could imagine financially, and also with respect at that point familially, everything seems to work for a period of time, and Constance ends up being educated at a boarding school. Don't get me wrong, I personally do not think boarding school is the best place for a child. Everybody is entitled to an opinion. I'm sure that some of you will have had an amazing experience at boarding school. Personally, particularly when those schools take children at the age of 7, I think it can create really severe attachment and abandonment issues. But again, everybody is entitled to their own opinion. But basically, we're talking about a young woman who's been brought up in immense privilege. Obviously, she's had a lot of opportunities because of the family connections and the family wealth. Now, in 1996, Napier and Virginie separate. Napier then moves to Australia. That's going to be an upsetting experience, particularly if you do have some attachment and abandonment issues, because obviously your father leaving and choosing not just to leave the actual partner, but choosing to leave the literal country and move as far away as one can imagine, that's going to be challenging for any child. Now, in 1998, so just a couple of years later, Virginie remarried a guy called Guy de Sellers. So quite a quick transition between partners as well. And that's going to be challenging for any children. At the end of the day, we like things that feel consistent. We like to know what's happening in our environment. And when things change very quickly beyond our control, that can be a very challenging experience. So certainly Constance has been through some issues in that respect. Now, in 2006, Constance Martin's mother takes her to the Holy Trinity in Brompton. It's a church in London. So she became at this point an apparent enthusiastic member. And I guess that speaks to me about the psychology of Constance Martin, because I think about somebody who might have had some dysfunction, might have felt a level of destabilization in her environment, might have been dealing with things like attachment and abandonment issues because of her boarding school experience. And then she finds a place where she can become a member of a congregation, and she feels safe and she feels secure and she feels there is a divine purpose. And they can be very alluring, grounding qualities for somebody who's felt a little bit out of kilter, a little bit unanchored because of the things that have gone on in her world. Now, when she's 19 years of age, she's so taken with what the church can do and the conviction of that and the community aspect that she ends up going to Nigeria to spend time at Synagogue Church of All Nations. It's known as SCOAN. Now, the founder of SCOAN was T.B. Joshua. Now, she spent around 4 months there. She was living on a compound. She was a disciple of Joshua, and then she returns to the UK. Whenever the words disciple is used in our modern territory, I just immediately think cult. Massive cult undertones there. Nobody should be a disciple of anybody in this day and age. Yes, we may have mentors, we may have role models, we may have incredible teachers, but disciple, the power imbalance there just really speaks to me of something sinister. Now, Joshua died in 2021. One of the things that came out after his death was there were a lot of allegations of abuse at SCOAN. Unsurprisingly, whenever there are cult-like undertones, there are also clear evidence on the whole of types of abuse, such as sexual and physical, and a whole heap of other spiritual manipulation and emotional abuse too. The BBC reported that ex-members accused Joshua of beatings, sleep deprivation, rape, forced abortions, and some disciples even being put in solitary confinement for loads of time, extended periods, where they were just locked away by themselves. And if that doesn't sound like a cult to you, I don't know what would. Now, a friend of Martin who met her at SCOAN described it as a place of literal torture. She said that when she met Martin, Martin was bright, witty, compassionate, funny, kind, and just really, truly independent. Now, Martin herself, she hasn't publicly reported experiencing abuse from her time spent at the compound, but someone who knew her well said, Constance was badly traumatized by the whole thing. Everyone talks about the two Constances, the person she was before she went to Nigeria and the person who came home. She was profoundly and fundamentally changed. Now, if you think about being 19 years of age, you may have struggled with personal trauma because of your past experiences, whether that's a breakdown in the relationship with your parents, whether it's going to boarding school, whether it's issues that you haven't actually voiced. If you then go somewhere where you believe you're going to find a better life, you're going to do amazing work, you're going to be involved in a church, and you're going to take that spiritual value that you've found and use it in a really positive way, then you end up being mind and brainwashed by a cult leader, made to feel lesser than on many levels, because that's what you do. You break somebody down so that you can then build them in a way that you wish to build them. And then at that age where your brain is still developing, you're going through all of these issues, it does make perfect sense that people would have seen her as a completely different person before she goes to Nigeria to who comes home. And also, if she's had that fundamental experience of being abused in such a horrendous way and made to feel that she needs a guide, because bear in mind, she was known as a disciple of this individual, then it makes sense that she may look in the wrong places to find that guide. She may look at an individual who's quite strong and aggressive and confident and bold and view that person as an individual who would be appropriate to actually have a relationship with, because she's looking for that leader. And of course, that can take you down some horrible roads. And I think that when you look at the case that we're looking at today, that certainly resonates as far as I'm concerned. Now, back in the UK, Martin actually starts working as a model. She's a very attractive young woman. In 2008, she actually attends Leeds University. She took a course on Arabic and Middle Eastern studies, and that time at university even included a year in Cairo. So she's well-travelled, and she's obviously trying to think about a positive future. And in 2009, quite a strange thing occurs for somebody who comes from aristocracy, I would imagine. She's named Babe of the Month in Tatler magazine. Tatler magazine is a high-end magazine in the UK, but Babe of the Month doesn't really feel or sound very aristocratic, in my opinion. Now, after university, she begins pursuing a career as a journalist. She accepted a job as a senior researcher at Al Jazeera, which is the media network. And she also, for a time, worked as a nanny in Switzerland. At that point, she decides that she wants to go to a drama school. She attends East 15 Drama School, but she ends up dropping out. So again, just going through some of those particular jobs and opportunities and aspirations, it seems to be that she's not necessarily very consistent in her approach. So she tries things, leaves, tries another thing, leaves, and so on and so forth. And again, that speaks to me of somebody who doesn't necessarily know what they want for the future. And I guess that part of the challenge that she has is that she's got a trust fund, which to you and I would feel brilliant, because let's be honest, if you're paid monthly an amount of money that you have to do no work for, well, you're kind of living the dream, aren't you? It's as simple as that. But it can also mean that you don't commit to things because you don't have to. You're always going to get payment. And she actually received £3,400 on a monthly basis. Also, she could request one-time payments. So let's say she wanted to buy a house. She could ask for a large deposit for that. She applied for £13,000 of the trust at one point. She wanted a laptop. She wanted camera equipment. So these are big chunks of money, and that allows her to do whatever she wants to do with her life with respect. But like I said, psychologically, it can also mean that you don't feel the need to commit, because you can travel, you can undertake any education you want, you don't have to worry about how you're going to fund it. And one of the motivations in our capitalist society, particularly in the UK, is that you need money to live, and therefore you take a job on the whole that you're going to feel vocationally attached to, give you a sense of purpose, and they're really positive psychologically. But if you did have this lump of money just falling into your bank account every month, it can temper that desire to have that purpose, which actually is counterproductive in nature. And I do feel that in this case, that examples how it can work against you, not for you. Now, people who knew Martin said she was a really great person. I've got to say, I've looked at comments from a whole heap of individuals who knew her. They had positive things to say about her. One friend that she met through the church said that she was, quote, the most lovely girl, who had such a huge smile that just lit up the whole room. They said that she had this way of making everybody feel warm and happy, and people were really drawn to her. So there's like a natural charisma there. Others described her as well-liked, sweet-natured, warm, friendly, very down-to-earth, that she had a really good heart. But she's also said to have been wild and strong-willed. So there's that juxtaposition there as well. But for the most part, people genuinely warmed to her, found her very easy to be around. She was a great communicator. She was very beautiful. She has everything going for her. But we always know, don't we, that beneath the surface, there can be really troubled waters, and you can present in a way where everybody thinks that you're happy and well-adjusted, but actually you're dealing with a level of trauma that no one's aware of. Now, in 2014, we get our sliding doors moment. And it really is a sliding doors moment because Martin meets Mark Gordon and she meets him in an Indian incense shop of all places in London. I imagine the aromas were delightful in that place in the moment that they connected. Maybe that added to this idea of a romantic universal connection. So he was born on June the 8th, 1974 in London. Gordon, his siblings and his mother, who was from Jamaica, moved to America. His mother was actually a nurse. She was raising children as a single parent. And Gordon would later say that his mother was really empathic and she was excellent at teaching him empathy. I do challenge him on this point with respect because I'm going to tell you, I don't think Gordon's a very empathic person, even in the slightest. Anyway, that's my own personal judgment. You can let me know whether you agree. So he had a criminal history when he was just 14 and living in Florida, America. He'd actually committed a number of really violent crimes. So on April the 29th, 1989, he had literally broken into a neighbor's home and repeatedly raped her at knife point. Also, he was holding garden shears as a weapon. He held a hostage in the bedroom for around 4.5 hours. He threatened to harm her two young children who were literally sleeping in the house. He said, "Don't scream or I'll kill your children." Could you be any more deviant and diabolical than that? I don't believe so. And that's the kind of mark of this man. And the following month, on May the 21st, he actually broke into another home, violently attacked a man who'd been asleep in bed with a shovel. Literally with a shovel. Now, the man's wife and baby, they'd been in the house, and they actually managed bravely to chase Gordon away, despite the fact that he was severely injured and his wife had a baby there as well. They still managed to basically get him away. Now, in 1990, he was sentenced to 40 years in prison for that, and that is a sentence that he 100% deserved. Now, at his hearing, the woman that he raped, she said, "Please protect the innocent by keeping the guilty in prison for his life. Show him no mercy. Show him the guilty are punished and not merely chastised." And I think most of us can completely acknowledge that meaning within that statement. The idea that she has got a life sentence because of what this man did to her. A life sentence. So why should he ever walk free? She further went on to say, "He showed me no mercy, so show him no mercy and save the other women out there. I think he's just evil." And I think I can absolutely agree with those sentiments. I mean, to actually break into somebody's home and to rape them at knife point is something despicable beyond measure. Now, he only served 20 years, as in 2010, he gets released on parole and he's deported to the UK. Now, in England, he ends up working as a labourer. This is prior to him meeting Martin. And when they do meet, they begin dating around 2016. And of course, they believe that they're soulmates. And at this point, the relationship becomes quite serious. So he is older than her, much more experienced, has had a very checkered past. And she is vulnerable, I would say. So when they meet, he definitely has the upper hand power-wise, and I think she's searching for something. We've seen that with the church. We've seen that with her going and being a disciple at a cult, essentially. We've seen this in the way that people relate to who she used to be versus who she's becoming. This idea of the fact that there is something missing in her life and that she's looking to fill that gap. And he may prove to be, in that moment when they meet at least, the gap she believes needs filling. But obviously we all know how very quickly these kind of predators can get into an individual's life and convince them that they are the answer to all of their prayers, when actually they are the stuff of nightmares. Now in 2017, the couple go traveling, of course. She's got money coming in every month, how convenient. And that means that he is going to benefit. He's not gonna have to worry too much because financially they are solvent. They end up getting married. This is in Peru. It's not actually recognised as being a legal marriage in the UK, but nonetheless, it cements their commitment to one another. Now, after the couple begin dating, Constance Martin starts putting distance between herself and the rest of her family, which is a massive red flag. For anybody out there, if you have a partner who starts to create problems between you and your family, it isn't because they're struggling with your family. It's that they don't want you to have access to your family because then you won't get any support. So when they do awful things to you, you're going to have a more difficult time getting any kind of connection because you've cut off those ties. According to reports, Constance Martin's family don't approve of the relationship. And that makes perfect sense. I've got two daughters. If they brought home a convicted rapist, Well, he better have his running shoes on, for a start. I don't care how much in love she thinks she is. That's not an appropriate relationship. I don't want him within 1,000 feet of her. So understandably, they're not going to be happy with her choice in relationship, and they won't want her to remain in the relationship because of all those previous convictions. They also believed that Gordon was really controlling, and when they started to receive texts from Martin, they felt that that wasn't her texting them, it was actually him. Just the way that they were written didn't resonate as her. As time goes on, also, this isolation increases, so they're seeing her less and less and less, and then once they've got married in this faux marriage in Peru, she actually tells the family she's going to cut them out of her life and that she doesn't want to hear from them again, which is utterly bizarre. Now, some family members attempted to reach out, but they were just unsuccessful in retaining that relationship, and she did indeed cut the family out. Now, this is terrible because we have a young woman who is in a relationship with a very violent person who's been very, very dangerous in his past and has caused major trauma to other human beings. Now she's got connected to him. They are becoming less able to have any kind of relationship with her, and in fact, in the end, are completely exempt from any relationship with her, meaning that she has no support structure. He can do whatever he wants to her, and she has no way of essentially connecting with them because she's cut those ties off. And that is exactly what we know high-level perpetrators will do. You want to isolate, you want to alienate, you want to cause issues and friction in families because that means that you have the person that is your prey, essentially, as well as your partner, all to yourself. Now, Martin had actually got pregnant when they were traveling around South America with Gordon. Now, on her return to the UK, one of the things that she'd been advised about was the fact that the Zika virus was a risk. So, understandably, they wanted to at antenatal check her out and make sure that they were attending to her closely so that they knew if there were going to be any problems with the baby. But she hadn't been attending the prenatal checks. And so at this point, a national hospital alert was raised. So a national hospital alert is where if you go in and you give your name and your address, it will immediately connect with the fact that they are looking for you. And that means that the authorities can be called in to check on you, to make sure that you are okay, to make sure that the welfare of the child that's unborn is okay, and so on and so forth. Now, in addition to this national hospital alert, Martin's family actually hire a private detective. They want to find her desperately. So you can see that as far as Martin's family is concerned, they want her in their lives. They want her to be safe. They're desperately concerned about her. They're going to their own costs of hiring a private detective, just hoping to bring her back into the family hold. Now, when it's time for Martin to give birth, she actually goes to a hospital, but she provides a false name. Isabel O'Brien is what she calls herself. So she's in a hospital in Wales. She also goes to the lengths of disguising her voice. She uses an Irish accent. She tells staff that she's a traveller, that Gordon's a friend, and that basically she's got into labour. Now, she later says the reason that she did that was due to the fact that she believed her family was oppressive and bigoted. Now, I think we can all appreciate that maybe aristocracy individuals can come across sometimes a little bit bigoted, a little bit arrogant, and it's not because they actually are, it's just because their lifestyle is so unbelievably different to ours that the expectations might be slightly different. For example, if we look at communities which are, shall we say, Muslim or Hindu, you also get a sense in certain families that honour is really powerfully important. I'm not talking about honour killings, I'm talking about honour. So an expectation of how you will behave. But if you live a more ordinary Western lifestyle, like I do, we have far more liberal understanding and belief systems around our children, for example. We want them to make their own choices and to have that life that they choose. And we don't necessarily exert upon them the pressure that might occur if you happen to come from the trappings that I'm talking about where this aristocracy is concerned. But the idea that they're oppressive to her when she's literally choosing to be with a man who is highly abusive, who is a known rapist and criminal, that seems a little bit on the ironic scale because you cannot be more oppressive than being a domestic abuser. And believe me, 100% she's with a domestic abuser. But this is why she uses this particular trope. It's an excuse for being with him as opposed to being with them. They can offer her support, structure, finance, lifestyle, opportunity, education, and so on and so forth, but apparently that makes them oppressive and bigoted, whereas the guy that she's with can offer her violence and nothing more. with respect, the fact that she's casting aspersions on her family, it kind of sticks in your throat a little bit when you think about who she's spending her time with. So staff at the hospital end up calling the police because of the national alert, and when they arrive at the hospital, Gordon gives officers a fake name. And one of the things he does when he gives them the fake name is he also tells them his birthday was April the 31st. Just going to throw it out there. It's not going to be very helpful for the police because April the 31st doesn't actually exist. So at this point, just to try to alleviate the situation, you know, calm things down, Gordon ends up getting into a physical altercation with the female officers. So that's how he handles it. He sort of sounds like such a great guy, doesn't he? He's just the kind of guy that you want to be around, particularly the fact that he's attacking female officers. And this is on a maternity ward as well, so just the perfect environment, you know? Women have just given birth, feeling quite vulnerable, a little bit overwhelmed, obviously euphoric, and then all of a sudden, this guy is attacking women on the ward in front of you. I mean, that's going to make you feel a sense of calm and peace that you really require in the moments after literally having given birth. Now, understandably, he gets restrained and restraints are put on him, but again, what's it telling you about consequences? He doesn't think of them. What's it telling you about boundaries? He doesn't have any. What does it tell you about violence? He's quite happy to punch a female. That's what it's telling you. And unfortunately, Constance Martin is in a relationship with this man. And if he's doing that to strangers that he has a small altercation with because of a mistake that he makes, because of a fabrication they're creating, imagine the kind of behaviour that goes on in his intimate relationship where he will ultimately wish to have full control. Now, another father on that ward actually helped the police to restrain him because at the end of the day, good men really don't like it when bad men are acting this way towards female police officers or female of any type. And it turns out the reason that they were so against giving their actual names and being clear to the authorities who they were wasn't just because of the fact that they didn't want the family to know where Constance Martin was. It was also to do with the fact that her violent partner basically was wanted by the police at that point because he wasn't following the conditions of being on the sex offenders register. He sounds like such a dreamboat, isn't he? I mean, when you imagine about your prince that will come, you imagine a guy who's violently raped people, hit people with spades, and is also somebody who is avoiding following the guidelines of being on the sex offenders register because he's actually a sex offender. He just sounds like the perfect person that you want to spend your life with. Now, at this point, he ends up being arrested. He's given 20 weeks in prison because he assaulted the two officers in the struggle. So effectively, he actually misses the first weeks of his child's life. It also makes you ask the question, what on earth is Constance Martin seeing in him? But again, bear in mind that these crimes, which are very, very serious, played out in America. People tell stories, don't they? People can create a narrative and a spin on even the most evil of situations. And if somebody is in love with you, that person will obviously believe in the bias of positivity towards you. There is a strong likelihood he manipulated Constance Martin. And I'm not excusing her actions, by the way. What I'm talking about today is very, very serious, and she certainly deserves consequences. But what I'm saying is I strongly believe that he will have manipulated a spider's web of deceit, which has convinced her that he is actually not the guy that he is seen to be in, shall we say, the newspapers and in the court reports, that actually it was just this horrible misunderstanding. So many perpetrators of violence are so effective at spinning a yarn that completely reels in their prey, in this case, a partner. Now, understandably, at this moment in time, social services become very, very concerned about what's going on in this couple's life. They end up intervening. They also apply for supervision because they find out that Martin is living in a tent with a newborn baby. Bear in mind, it's really cold weather at the time. Now, when Gordon's released from prison, the couple end up moving to London. They actually begin renting a rundown terraced house. Now, I do appreciate London is astronomically expensive. I don't know how people live in a flat and get to eat dinner every night when they are living in London, because you can forget breakfast and you can forget your lunch because it's really expensive, and accommodating the cost is almost exponentially impossible as far as I'm concerned. But even though I can acknowledge the fact that rent is very expensive in London, the fact that they rent a really run-down terrace is weird, because The truth is, she has opportunities to get some money. It's bizarre to me that she'd choose to live in a lifestyle like that when she could have had a trust fund, she could have easily got herself a nice house to raise a family in because she would have been provided for. Now, don't get me wrong, I do appreciate there are some individuals who seem to have a real issue with being privileged, particularly in our modern era where if you are fortunate enough to have a level of privilege, you're meant to feel guilty for it. So if you have that psychological connection and Constance Martin May, where she feels bad for having these opportunities, then it could be that she just wants to choose to reject it for a more modest life. But she could have chosen a small, safe home that was appropriate for raising young children, that had access to education and healthcare and so on and so forth. It feels like she's actively working against herself in these situations. And there are a number of times that social services try to help, but Constance Martin is really resistant to this. She's also very resistant to authority, and that plays in once again to the idea that I have about the way that Gordon is brainwashing her to make her afraid of the very people who want to actually protect and help her. Think about his experiences with authority. It led to 20 years in prison, and he deserved every second of that. But has he twisted and turned her mindset to believe that authorities are out to get them, as he's tried to suggest they were out to get him, as opposed to him actually accepting accountability and responsibility for the crimes that he carried out? That could be at play here. Now, in April 2019, Martin gives birth to a second baby. Bear in mind, again, she hadn't received any antenatal care. She actually gave birth in their rented home. And with respect, there are lots of women out there who feel that free births at home are best for them, and all power to them. Personally, for me, it's a bit scary because I always think that I'd like some medical intervention if I required it. But like I said, I'm not criticizing somebody making a choice to actually go ahead and give birth in their own home. But she isn't doing it for a nice experience. She isn't doing it because she thinks a home birth is going to be more relaxing. She's clearly doing it because she doesn't want the authorities involved. And again, that's probably because she has this full belief system that they are out to get her. Now, on November the 21st, 2019, a very, very strange and deeply concerning, and I would say sinister, event occurs. Constance Martin falls out of a first story window at their home. Now, I don't know about you. I've got first story windows in my own home. I'm sat in a home that has a first story window right here. I would never fall out of it because you never get close enough or unbalanced enough or put yourself in a position where that's actually possible. The truth is, just so you all know, if I fall out of my first story window, somebody will have pushed me. It's as simple as that. Now, an ambulance gets called, but not by Gordon. He doesn't call the ambulance. And you just think, if your partner, the mother of your child, has fallen out of a first floor window and is in pain, you're going to ring the emergency services. You're going to want to get help for her immediately. It's actually her neighbours who hear her screaming, "Help me." Now, when paramedics arrive, what Gordon does is invite them in, makes them feel comfortable, explains what's happening. No, he doesn't. What he does is he refuses to let them into their home at all, so she can't have any assistance provided at this point. Now, thankfully, they do get access, and when they eventually get to see Constance Martin, she gets taken to hospital. She's got lacerations to one of her kidneys. She also has a shattered spleen, so deeply serious injuries. Could have been fatal. It's as simple as that. Also, add to this, at the time of that fall, in inverted commas, Martin had been 14 weeks pregnant with their third child. Thankfully, somehow the baby lived despite those awful injuries that she experienced. Now, Martin absolutely insisted it wasn't an incident of domestic violence. She also repeatedly tried to leave the hospital during her 8-day stay. But how often do we hear about victims protecting their perpetrator? How often is somebody so brainwashed in these relationships, so coercively controlled, so desperately afraid that they will say whatever they need to say to protect the person who's actually needing to be put to the courts and locked away for a long period of time? But like I said, this is a constant theme in domestically abusive relationships. Now, in December 2019, Martin's father, Napier, hears about the fall. He immediately applies for temporary guardianship of his grandchildren because he's obviously a decent human being who thinks they're all at risk. He also suggests at this point that he can buy a nice house in Dorset for both Martin and for the children, that they can hire a nanny to care for the children until Martin is well enough to be with them. And Martin is apparently horrified at this suggestion, and she ends up running away to Ireland with her children. Now, she does return to England after a while, and the reason for that is that Gordon doesn't travel. He's not allowed to. He can't have a passport because of all those legal troubles in his background. But again, there we have the perfect potential for her, an opportunity to be cared for, have a nanny, have a beautiful place to live in a gorgeous area of England. And she finds that reprehensible enough to literally hoof it to Ireland. So she isn't thinking about the needs and welfare of the children in this moment. She's thinking about her personal feelings and discontent towards her father. And that is deeply upsetting because, with respect, those children deserve so much better. Now, in May 2020, their third child is born. And then in May 2021, the couple have a fourth baby. So she's kept pregnant pretty much throughout their entire relationship. Again, what do we know about perpetrators? Well, they like doing that. A woman is highly vulnerable when she is pregnant. You can double the threat when she's pregnant because the unborn child can be harmed as well. So she is in the perfect place and position for a perpetrator to do as they wish with them. Now, in January 2022, a fact-finding judgment's made by a family court. And the judge in that family court says, I find on the balance of probabilities that the father caused the mother to fall out of the window. I'm not able to find whether he pushed her or whether she fell during a struggle. The former may be more likely. The strong impression given by the parents is that of two people who are fiercely united in an unrelenting struggle against a non-existent opponent. I conclude that the parents have repeatedly prioritised their own need for privacy and secrecy above their children's health. Essentially, these parents have rolled the dice three times in refusing the vast majority of standard maternity and newborn healthcare and checks. They've been lucky each time, but plenty of pregnancies do involve complications which, if unchecked or untreated, can become life-threatening for the mother or the baby or both. The judge also commented how Martin had failed to show up to the pre-arranged visits with her children, which had apparently left them inconsolable. Now, don't get me wrong, she didn't not turn up to all those pre-arranged visits. In fact, when they did turn up to the pre-arranged visits, apparently the loving interactions played out. It was clear that there was a very loving relationship between Martin and the kids. But the fact that she wouldn't turn up to many of those meetings that were arranged, leaving the kids desperately upset, that again demonstrates a lack of care, a lack of understanding, and a willingness to prioritise her needs over her children's. It could have been that she was being prevented from going because Gordon didn't want her to go by herself and so on and so forth, but nonetheless, the children suffer in this case. Now, because of all of these things, because of the concerns, because of the worry about violence, because of the fact that her life could have been at threat from falling out of that window, stroke being definitely pushed by Gordon, understandably, the court have to make some very challenging decisions. And it is pretty catastrophic for Martin because all four children are removed from them and all four children are put up for adoption, which is traumatising, without a shadow of a doubt. Now, I can stand in an objective capacity and say that's the best thing for the kids. Martin and Gordon were unfit parents on their own. Their actions have demonstrated that. It is desperately upsetting that Martin wouldn't accept the help of a family, because if she had done that, she would have been able to keep her children. And the fact that she prioritises the relationship with him, a man who's clearly really awful to her, over the opportunity to be a parent just seems really remiss on her part. But again, she's indoctrinated, no doubt, into this relationship in a way where probably he makes all the decisions for her. So I think we can all agree there is just such a sense of finality about the decision to have those children adopted. And that means it's never going to be temporary. It's going to be a permanent placement. And I think when the judge talked about the fact that she and Gordon saw this opposition that didn't exist, well, the very fact that all the children have now been taken into permanent adoption scenarios, it does exist for her. So that's definitely going to be in a reinforcer where her psychology is concerned. She's absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt, going to feel aggrieved and devastated by those actions, even though those actions I completely understand needed to take place. Now, after the grandmother says that she's willing to take the children, she is allowed to read the files on those children. And at this point, she changes her mind, essentially. So she decides that the relationship between Gordon and her daughter was an enmeshed and abusive one, and believed that she wouldn't be able to safely care for the children. So that means that the children are going to be adopted outside of the family. And like I said, Virginia had to make that decision, but I imagine that was a difficult one to come to terms with, because one would hope that the children remained within the family unit. But I understand the potential is the concern for Gordon and for Martin to try to gain access to those children, and that could be very problematic on a wider scale for the family. Now, on December the 20th, 2022, what we know is that Martin and Gordon stay in a rental holiday cottage. On December the 24th, this is whilst they're staying at the holiday cottage, Martin gives birth to yet another baby girl, a girl that they name Victoria. Now, the reality is nobody knew that Martin had been pregnant at this point. So after baby Victoria was born, the couple just kept the baby secret. The birth wasn't registered. They didn't receive any postnatal care. And the reason for that is they wanted to avoid the baby being taken away from them. And it makes sense. Let me tell you, I've worked in this area. If you have had four children adopted from your care, you are not seen as an appropriate parent unless something has systematically changed in your life. And I mean, it would have to be a universal shift in the way that you are and the way that you've been. You are not going to be able to keep your child. Unfortunately, this is the way the system works. And it works like that because the needs of the child are considered paramount and the needs of the parent are secondary to that, and rightfully so, because babies are vulnerable and can't take care of themselves. But they know this, they're wise to this, so they don't want it to happen. So they're preventing anyone being aware that they've even had a child. Now, this all comes to an end because of what happens on the 5th of January, 2023. At this point, the emergency services are called to a burning car. It had been abandoned on the side of a motorway, the M61, in the Halliwell area of Bolton, Greater Manchester. I kid you not, 15 minutes away from where I live. And obviously, that provokes a reaction, because who are the owners of this car? What on earth has happened? Are people in danger? But when they arrive at the car, there isn't anybody present. The owners of the car were later identified as being Martin and Gordon, because they had left a number of possessions in there. It included mobile phones, Martin's passport, £2,000 in cash and clothing. Let me tell you, I wouldn't have let that go up in flames. And among the possessions, they also found a decomposing placenta on the back seat that had actually been covered up with a towel. Now, I'm going to assume that they thought that everything had gone up in flames and that these things weren't going to be recovered. And I also can assume that they wanted to get away as fast as possible from that scene because they knew that the police would be coming. And they're bearing in mind they're trying to avoid being discovered, particularly with a baby. Now, understandably, the fact that they found a placenta means that the police are worried about the welfare of the mother and the baby. Because if you had a baby recently, you might have lost a lot of blood. That would mean that you're a high risk, and they want to make sure that the mother is safe. So this search is highly reported by the media. It literally set the nation on fire. Also, at this point, there are a number of sightings that are reported over the next few weeks. This is whilst the couple are indeed on the run and they're living off-grid. At this point, a £10,000 reward is offered for any information which resulted in them being found safely. On January the 19th, 2023, Constance Martin's father, Napier, made an appeal to his daughter in the Independent newspaper.
Darling Constance, even though we remain estranged at the moment, I stand by, as I have always done, and as the family has always done, to do whatever is necessary for your safe return to us. I beseech you to find a way to turn yourself and your wee one into the police as soon as possible, so you and he or she can be protected.
I would like you to understand that the family will do all that is needed for your well-being. And I also wish you to understand you are much, much loved, whatever the circumstances. We are deeply concerned for you and your baby's welfare. The past 8 years have been beyond painful for all the family, as well as your friends, as they must have been for you. And to see you so vulnerable again is testing in the extreme. So you can clearly hear in that request that he's beseeching her to contact them, to make herself safe, to come back to the fold of the family. This is not a family who've completely deserted Constance Martin. They want her in their lives. They understand the predicament that she's in. And I sense that they feel that she has been in a scenario where she has been brainwashed to some degree by the man that she's with. And again, I am going to absolutely acknowledge she has a responsibility and accountability to her children and to her family that she so far hasn't come through with. But I genuinely believe this is because she has been in a situation where she's been living with a predator for a very long time. Now, in February 2023, Martin's mother, Virginie, published an open letter addressed to her daughter offering her support. She said, "You are not alone in this situation. We will support you in whatever way we can. I know you well enough. You are focused, intelligent, passionate, and complex with so much to offer the world. So many of your friends have come forward to say such positive things about you, assuring us of their warmest love and support for you and your family. You have made choices in your personal adult life which have proven to be challenging. However, I respect them. I know that you want to keep your precious newborn child at all costs. With all that you have gone through, this baby cannot be removed from you, but instead needs looking after in a kind and warm environment. I want to help you and my grandchild. You deserve the opportunity to build a new life, establish a stable family, and enjoy the same freedoms that most of us have. Constance, I will do what I can do to stand alongside you and my grandchild. You are not alone in this situation. We will support you in whatever way we can. I am ready to do what it takes for you to recover from this awful experience so you can thrive and enjoy motherhood. I love you and miss you, Mum." On February the 27th, 2023, finally, Martin and Gordon are arrested. This is after a nearby sighting by a member of the public. They had used Martin's bank card, so at this point, police were alerted and they were indeed able to find them. However, who they couldn't find at that point was baby Victoria. She was nowhere to be seen. Also, the couple are completely uncooperative from the start. They refuse to answer questions about where the baby is, whether she's alive. Gordon at this point is limping, is walking with a stick. He's actually wearing just one shoe because he's got an infected toe. And it's very, very clear. Both of them are unbelievably weak. In fact, Gordon seems to be asking for food when he's being arrested. Now, tragically, on the 1st of March 2023, the decomposing body of baby Victoria was discovered in a shed on Lower Rodale allotments. She'd been wrapped in a blanket, she'd been placed in a little bag for life, and she'd been placed under a pile of rubbish, which included sandwich wrappers, beer cans, Coke cans, and some newspaper pages. And that is distressing beyond belief. The idea that your newborn baby's body would be thrown away like trash is something that is hard to reconcile, particularly in the backdrop of parents who apparently wanted to keep this child and wanted to keep this child safe. Now, after Martin was told that her baby had been found, she did actually begin answering questions. Now, a timeline of the couple's no movements ended up being mapped out. So it came down to December the 26th, which is just 2 days after the baby was born. They left the holiday cottage in Northumberland. They travelled towards Leeds. Now, it turns out that that evening they had trouble with a car late at night and it had to be recovered. They were then taken to Sainsbury's car park. On January the 4th, they then stayed at a Limb Services hotel in Cheshire. They then stayed at the AC Hotel in Manchester. Then on January the 5th, this is the night that their car had set alight, a passing car gave both of them a lift to a shop in Bolton. Now, prior to this, unbelievably, as far as I'm concerned, they had actually abandoned their cat at the side of the road because they thought it would be too difficult to transport a newborn and a pet without their car. The idea that you'd just be like, "Oh, I'm just going to let my cat go." I mean, how dangerous for the animal? And again, what does it show you? A lack of care or consequence. And that's on both of their parts in that moment. Now, after they've done this, they take a taxi to Liverpool. They then take another taxi from there to Horwich in Essex. They then end up staying the night at a Premier Inn hotel. They check in at 3 a.m. And this is all with a newborn baby. Just bear that in mind. Now, they spent the following night in a pub hotel. Then they're spotted at a ferry port. It's suspected that at this point they were trying to leave the country, but you can't leave the country without ID, and they didn't show the ID. Now, a member of the public had called in the sighting at the ferry port, said that he'd ended up offering them a hot drink at his house, but Gordon had declined, told him that they were going to go and stay with loved ones in London. They're then seen on CCTV in East Ham in London. They were also seen in a kebab shop. This is when they put their baby in a pram. They then travel in a taxi to Whitechapel. This is where they buy a tent, pillows, and sleeping bags from Argos. They then get into a taxi and they ask the driver to take them to Enfield, but the driver asks them to get out of the taxi in Haringey because they're covering their faces, obviously disconcerted the driver, understandably so. After that, they then take another taxi to New Haven. Now, from January the 8th, they are believed to have slept in the tent. And Martin said that her daughter Victoria passed away on January the 9th. Now, bear in mind, it's really freezing temperatures, and I'm not imagining that the tent they bought was an expert tent that you would be using somewhere in incredibly cold climates. I would imagine they've just bought a very standard one, and people don't understand how dangerously low temperatures fall in those particular tents. Now, on the 12th of January, Martin went to a petrol station. She bought some food, she bought a bottle of petrol, and initially the reason they did that is they planned to use the petrol to cremate their daughter. But then Constance Martin decides that she wants an autopsy, which is bizarre because they haven't registered the birth. They haven't told the authorities that a child has even been born. And yet she's imagining that they could just have an autopsy on this baby's body. It literally makes no sense. Now, don't get me wrong, I think there is a level of trauma where Constance Martin is concerned, and the likelihood is she's not thinking clearly or with clarity, and she's also feeling a level of guilt. She genuinely potentially doesn't know how the child died. Maybe there is a level of responsibility that she feels she's had a part to play in the death, and she wants to clarify that. So even though it would be impossible to just walk into a hospital and say, I'd just like an autopsy on my deceased daughter's body, because questions would be asked, understandably, it does speak to a level of trauma about the child's passing and Victoria and Constance Martin's reaction to it. Now, on January the 16th, a member of the public see the tent in the nature reserve in Stanmer Park near Brighton. Another sighting of that tent is in Seaford at the Seven Sisters Cliffs near the end of January. Then on February the 20th, Martin and Gordon were actually seen searching through the bins at Hollingbury Golf Course. This is after they've tried breaking into the golf course. They're obviously very hungry. Now, on February the 27th, they end up trying to steal food. They then use a cash machine, and that's ultimately how they are indeed captured by the authorities.
What? Oh, give me a second. Just give me a second.
Right. We can put your shopping down.
Sorry, I'm just going to check.
No. Right, at this moment in time, until I can confirm who you are, you're both under arrest on suspicion of child neglect. So you don't have to say anything, but it may harm your defence. If you don't mention when questioned, something was lying in court, anything you think of evidence. Do you ever understand? Do you have any ID on you? You have no ID on you.
Oh, look at the photo on
that. Oh, where's the child, madam?
Where is the child, please?
Daddy Bear.
Look at me.
Constance Arabella, whoever you are.
Right, where's your child? Have we searched her?
Now, during their travels, Martin and Gordon would cover their faces as best they could. They didn't want to get recognised. And in fact, Victoria was often completely hidden under Martin's zipped coat. However, towards the end of her life, she was carried around in a bag for life, which disturbs me on every single level. I mean, what on earth is happening that you would place a baby, a live baby, in a bag for life? It just speaks of neglect at the highest level. And bear in mind, these two are deluded in believing they're actually doing what's best for their baby girl. Now, on January the 15th, 2024, we get to where Martin and Gordon's trial begins. At this point, they're both charged with concealment of the birth of a baby, cruelty to their baby, and intending to pervert the course of justice by the concealment of their baby's body. They're also charged with allowing the death of their baby and gross negligence manslaughter. However, the manslaughter charge was as an alternative to the charge of allowing the death of their baby. Presumably, this means that they could only be charged with one of those two counts. Now, the prosecution claimed that the parents had willfully neglected or exposed Victoria to the elements in a manner likely to cause unnecessary suffering or injury to health. So they alleged that basically they'd failed to take care of the opportunities that they had in front of them, which meant they could have done something completely different and had completely different outcomes. Now, the post-mortem of Victoria, because ironically, Constance Martin did get her post-mortem after she was arrested, they weren't able to determine the cause of death. It could have been hypothermia. It could have been smothering. They couldn't exclude either of those things, but they couldn't determine the exact cause of death. Now, when it came down to Martin giving evidence, she was really upset. She described the day that Victoria died. She said they were sleeping in the tent. It was only the first night in the tent, and she had baby Victoria in her jacket. She said, when I woke up, she wasn't alive. I believe it was January the 9th. I feel guilty because she was in my arms. I feel like it's not an easy thing to live with. I think initially it was disbelief, shock, intense grief. She went on to say, I do feel guilty for falling asleep on her. I do feel responsible if that is what happened, because the autopsy is not complete. So she's basically taking responsibility, fundamentally saying that she was trying to keep Victoria warm in her jacket whilst in the tent. But as you all know, co-sleeping, which I do, I've done it with all of my children. Currently, I'm co-sleeping with a toddler and a newborn baby, but you do it in a safe way. I would certainly never have my baby attached to my chest, because all it takes is to roll over and you can suffocate your child. There are ways of doing it that are safe, and there are ways that are doing it that are unsafe, and that would be incredibly unsafe. But I also appreciate that wasn't Constance Martin actually trying to kill her baby, if that's how the baby died. It's a tragic mistake, a tragic accident. It should never have happened. There were other options, and it does make her culpable. But nonetheless, I don't think it's clear cut that this woman murdered her child under any circumstances. Now, Gordon, he later said that they didn't move away from the baby's body for three whole days. They actually considered taking their own lives. And she told the court that she and Gordon had spoken about what to do with baby Victoria's body. They discussed cremating the body, and they also discussed killing themselves after doing that. In fact, Martin in court went as far as to describe Victoria as their pride and joy, said that they were taking great care of her. Because I don't know about you, when I think about taking great care of a brand new, vulnerable newborn, I think carry them around in a bag for life. Keep them in a tent at freezing temperatures. I mean, who doesn't do that? Now, understandably, the prosecution immediately questioned her about the living arrangements, the fact that the baby had been exposed to such conditions in the middle of winter. And Martin said, there are people around the world who live in tents. There are children who live in igloos. As long as you give them warmth and love and food, I would, she said, have preferred not to have been in a tent. Not being funny, but yes, there are people who live in places around the world, such as igloos. Igloos are unbelievably thick ice buildings that are actually relatively warm within. And also, just gonna throw it out there, Constance Martin, also, the children are literally surrounded in furs. They're probably warmer than most of us in winter because they're so adapted and adept at that living environment. The same when you see children who are brought up in very hot countries. The families know how to deal with that because they are very adept at doing so. It's incredibly different when you live in the UK and you are not a survivalist, and no child is a survivalist. And I appreciate that love and nurture and warmth are very important, but that was not really being provided. That's a delusion of provision, not a reality. Being in a house was necessary. I mean, she does say in court that that would have been more preferable. But she also said, it was the only decision I had at the time. She was well cared for and well loved. Well, with respect, you may have loved her, but she wasn't well cared for. And she died because she wasn't well cared for. She also said, I showed my babies the maximum amount of love that I had to give. She also said that she didn't tell police where Victoria's body was because she was panicked and scared. She also told the court that by the time they were actually arrested, she and Gordon were very unwell. She said that Gordon was anorexically thin, and she said she realised that they couldn't live like this, not eating, sharing one piece of bread out of the bin. She said that wasn't sustainable. She said, so I said to Mark, we're going to have to get some money. She said, I knew as soon as I used the card, the police were going to come. But I said, baby, we need to get some food because the way we are living is completely unsustainable. So we went to the shop and bought food. Now, again, I appreciate why she chose to do that, but why is Gordon's care more important than the newborn baby's? With respect, the newborn baby was put at risk every single day until their death. But apparently when Gordon's very thin and needs help, she goes straight to the shop, knowing that it will lead to their arrest, ultimately to protect him. Just seems a little bit ironic that that's the way she acts towards her partner, as opposed as a primary caregiver to her child. Now, the court also were told that she'd received £47,886 from a trust fund between September the 1st, 2022 and January 17th, 2023. That's quite a lot of money with respect. That actually included £15,990 for a car. So they had means. It's as simple as that. They could have been renting. They could have been living somewhere nice, and they chose not to. Now, on May the 23rd, 2024, Martin and Gordon were found guilty on the counts of concealment, cruelty, and perverting the course of justice. However, the jury could not come to a decision regarding the counts of allowing the death of their baby and gross negligence manslaughter. So that meant that a retrial for those charges needed to be arranged. Now, the retrial took place in March 2025. Now, the defence, they argued that Victoria's death was an accident. Basically, a sleep-deprived mother had fallen asleep whilst breastfeeding her baby with absolutely tragic consequences. The prosecution, however, they argued that the baby had to endure cold, damp and windy conditions with wholly inadequate clothing inside that tent. They said it was simply too cold, she couldn't maintain a temperature and death was inevitable. Also, a social worker testified to say that Martin had been warned in 2017 that it was too dangerous to camp with a newborn baby. Gordon actually spoke at this trial. Now, at some point during the proceedings, he decided to part ways with his defence. And he did what so many successful cases are won doing, which is he represented himself. I am, of course, being very sarcastic there. It does not end well when somebody with no legal acumen or training thinks, well, I'll just do it. I'll be absolutely great. I'm going to be doing a way better job than my defence. Terrible idea. He actually emphasised during this case that his and Martin's state of mind were challenged. He said they were deranged, an effect of having their children taken from them. He said we weren't normal. He said it's like a vacuum, a hole, an emptiness you can never fill. He said at the back of his mind, he thought that they would hand Victoria into social services. He had no problem with the system, he said, but it's not a perfect system, he said. I don't want to stand in the Old Bailey with my wife and with my baby passed. I have to explain myself criminally for the loss of the baby I loved. Apparently, Gordon's voice began to tremble with emotion. He swayed in the witness box, his arms gesturing into the air. He said, I will never forget the pain, the feeling of picking my baby up. Now, by now, he's just in tears. And he says, we are the ones who have to live with what happened. You have to understand our perspective if you are judging us. And do I believe they didn't love or care for that child? No, I think they believed they loved and cared for that child. They just didn't do it at a level that was required for that child to thrive. And actually, at the end of the day, for that child to survive. And that is falling very much short of the expected bar. And you have to accept the consequences of that, even when those consequences end up in the Old Bailey in a criminal proceeding. Now, on July the 14th, 2025, Martin and Gordon were found guilty of manslaughter. Martin reportedly said it's a scam. Well, it's not, is there? Your baby died horribly. You could have got different outcomes. You went ahead and tried to evade the authorities. And the consequence of that is Victoria's dead. And somebody needs to pay the price. It's not a scam. It's called the British judiciary system. Both the initial trial and retrial, it was delayed on a number of occasions due to Martin and Gordon literally attempting to cause disruption to the child process. So, for example, Martin didn't come to court on multiple occasions. Sometimes she'd say it was toothache, but then when she was offered treatment for the toothache, she'd refuse it. Also, she was just yawning throughout her testimony, which doesn't look good because it seems like she's bored or that she has the arrogance to believe that she shouldn't have to be being questioned. And that, again, just isn't effective where a jury is concerned. She also announced during her testimony that Gordon had a violent rape conviction. Now, of course, the problem with that is that that can prejudice a jury. The jury aren't supposed to know it. And it was suggested that she'd actually done that as a deliberate attempt to sabotage the trial. Now, Gordon actually said he wanted to continue the trial. He didn't want to worry about the prejudice. And prosecutor Jaswant Nawal said, we were determined to seek justice for baby Victoria and honour her tragically short life. Martin and Gordon, they've shown very little remorse for their actions. They've used different antics to frustrate and delay court proceedings. That's been really challenging for the trials. And the prosecutor said no child should have had its life cut short in this preventable way. They went on to say, I hope these convictions provide a sense of justice and comfort to all those affected by this tragic case.
In terms of the roles you each played, in my judgment, it would be wrong to seek to distinguish between the two of you. I propose to treat you both as being equally culpable. Neither of you gave much, if any, thought to the care or welfare of your baby. Your focus was on yourselves.
Now, whilst understandably the prosecution, the jury and many, many people around the UK and around the world, indeed, agree with the outcome of this case, some of the people who feel personally affected by it don't. So speaking to the BBC, Martin's friend from Scone said, The story I see is very different from what you see on the headlines. The story that I see is a young girl who was taken to an awful place, was broken down, doesn't understand what happened to her, and is therefore unable to process what's happening to her now. She really, really needs help. Now, I do actually have some sympathy and empathy for Constance Martin. I really do, because I genuinely think that she's been traumatised and she's reacted to that trauma. Do I think that that means that she shouldn't serve a sentence in prison? Absolutely not. She 100% needs a custodial sentence, and for good reason, because she needs to understand that actions have consequences, and she will have a freedom one day, a freedom that her baby, Victoria, was not afforded. I do feel that she is a victim of domestic abuse. I do feel that she's been brainwashed, and I do believe that she is somebody who also needs help. And I genuinely believe that hopefully within the custodial system, that help is going to arrive. She is clearly a woman who needs psychological help. She believed that her children were stolen by the state. She seems to feel like the world was against her, including her own family, who were quite the contrary. She believed that by running away with her child, she was protecting her child, but ultimately trying to keep her child in her own custody meant that she caused her own child's death. Children aren't removed from parents without due reason. And I get it, there'll be some very occasional case where the system has been unfair, but for the most part, it is absolutely clear in these cases that children are moved for their own protection. It's clear that Martin and Gordon were not willing, in fact, to behave like fit parents. And I don't believe that she can see how selfish her actions were. She believes she gave Victoria the maximum love, but she can't comprehend how doing the most difficult thing, letting social services intervene to actually ensure that that baby girl be raised in a safe environment, would be providing the maximum love. She couldn't have seen that by answering the written statement in The Independent by her father or the other by her mother and actually acknowledging that they were offering support and taking that support would have been a far better choice than letting her baby either suffocate or die from cold in a tent in freezing temperatures when that child didn't need to be there. So I have every sympathy and empathy with Constance Martin being a victim, but she was also a perpetrator. She was a person who provided a lack of care to the point where her baby girl died. And that child did not deserve to die and certainly did not need to die. So I do have conflict in this case. I have conflict because I am seeing Constance Martin as a victim of a cult, as a victim of a man who she spent many years with, isolating her from her family and who was known to be violent. But also she is a perpetrator because she neglected her child to a point of death. And for that, there needs to be consequences. As ever, you may disagree with me. You may be hardline. You may think that she's equally culpable as Gordon. You may feel that she doesn't need a custodial sentence at all. Maybe she just needs to be given some psychiatric and psychological care, and from there she can go on to live a good life in society freely. Or maybe like me, you think that she needs a mixture of both. She needs custodial and she also needs to be provided with a psychological intervention that can help her come to her senses, that can undo the brainwashing that has clearly arrived, because she just feels, appears and seems to act like a cult member. She really does. And bear in mind, cults are coercive and relationships are coercive with partners. And she certainly has walked the bridge between both sides. Let me know your thoughts in the comments as ever. I'll see you again next time, my lovelies. Take care. Be safe. Just wanted to jump on and say that since I recorded this case, the sentencing for Constance Martins and Mark Gordon have actually been heard and they've both been given 14 years in prison. Some of you may think that's too long. Some of you will think that it's too lenient. I actually think they have been given a relatively long sentence. I'm glad that's the case. Victoria deserved parents who protected her and they failed in that way. However, I do feel that Constance Martins was less of the perpetrator in this crime. As ever, your thoughts are welcome. You may disagree with me completely. I just wanted to update you on this case. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.